The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. You can put your money to work by automating your savings and investments. Learn more at NavyFederal.org/saveandinvest.
Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This summer, Marcus makes me do this voice, so I'm going to do it every once in a while just to keep him happy with me. All right, I don't want to be on the bad side of that.
Nope.
Not a good place to be. We've got a great guest in store today, but before we do that, let's jump into a little Patreon question. I'm nervous about this one. What Netflix show would you be most embarrassed to admit that you have binge watched?
You're asking me that?
It's all of us.
We all have to answer. What's yours?
You know, I'm not even sure what's on Netflix, but I would say some kind of ballroom dancing. I probably wouldn't want to be associated with that.
I'll tell you which one got. Was it The Bling Life that Maria showed?
Oh, for sure.
Is that what it's called?
I don't think so, but it's an Asian TV series. It's a reality show.
It's a reality show. They're like lineage to a dynasty
out of one of
the dynasties, right? And I mean, one guy's a surgeon. I mean, they're high scale living.
It's like the richest Asians in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But they're not associated with like movies, but like sure. They live in that area, and it's a reality show following them around, and to see the amount of money they spend, like just on their kit, like they'll buy these Gucci diaper wraps and like just crazy stuff, like spending an absurd amount of money.
Anyways, that one got me.
But we both watched the whole thing.
I'm fans of theirs, right? Yeah.
We actually started to like some of the. Some of the people were like, "Oh my gosh!"
It got to the point where it was so extravagant. I was like, I was impressed.
Yeah,
you know, like I can't get mad anymore. Yeah. Like, dude, I'm just impressed how well y'all do that.
Yeah, and then they have one poor Asian that's like their token poor friend that they let hang out with them.
Oh yeah, right,
and
yeah.
We're like, we're that person because I mean the it's
yeah
so
if you have true Asian if you have a true Asian friend you'll know this like yeah. they don't have a lot of white friends like if they yeah. say that you're part of the white friend family it's a blessing we managed to get that call yeah. That's how we wound up watching
yeah.
that show. Life.
One of my best friends is Vietnamese and she's the one that told us about it and she calls us her token white friend
yeah
so nice. Yeah.
It's a hard call to get. I'm honored to have it. I don't care, you know, bitch, or you won't.
Yeah, whatever. You got another one, Melanie?
I would agree with that. I don't really like reality type stuff, but that show, it had my full attention. Yeah. I was so enamored with just their lifestyle. It's so bizarre to me. It was stuff that I never thought people would spend money on.
Yeah.
That I'm like, this is really happening in today's time. This isn't like king and king royalty.
Oh, I'll tell you what it is, man. It's the fact that, okay, so they live in modern day extravagance, but they follow old customs and traditions.
Uh-huh.
Or they try.
They try.
Because the elders are still there. Man, yeah, it's funny to watch them dance through all that. It truly is.
Yeah. And then to like see them try to go to the grocery store and buy something.
I think
normal.
This might be the best promo they've ever had in their entire life. Man.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't think we have the name.
The name's not right. Yeah, I'm totally messing that up. But
it's a new show. Bling Life.
You can't miss it.
Yeah. It should be called Crazy Rich Asians, but that's a movie.
Yeah, somebody already had that one.
Yeah, it's not that. It's something like that, though.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, John, you got one.
Grey's Anatomy.
Mm.
Grey's Anatomy.
Didn't you like that
That's
show?
A lovely show.
See, that show.
So I agree now, but I did not at first. And my wife was a big fan, and I used to make fun of her for watching it because of the soap opera aspect. But then I started watching it with her from the beginning, and I like Grey's Anatomy. And I just admitted it.
I think Marcus loves that show. I admit it.
Yeah.
He said it's a lovely show.
Yeah. That's the doctor one, right?
Yeah.
I never watched it, but I know when we first met, you had liked that show.
Yeah. What was it? Grimm? Supernatural?
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Oh, we love Supernatural.
Yeah.
So many. One, man. There's so many. Love is Blind is this terrible show on Netflix right now where these single men and women, they get into these pods. They can't see each other. They have no technology. They have no idea who's on the other side of the wall. And they just have to get to know each other for the first few weeks. And then they pick the person based on just conversations that they had to marry them. And they propose in these pods.
No.
And the first time they meet is after completely
that's
being
the way we did it.
Love is Blind.
Yeah, but that's terrible.
The way we did it?
No.
She said it.
We didn't have...
How about that, Mike?
We did not have...
All right, bro, let's go.
No, that's not right.
Our courtship was awesome.
He moved in with me the day after we met.
I said it was awesome.
Well, we have got a great guest in store. Mike Etor is a retired Marine Corps infantry officer and a decorated combat leader. He developed a reputation for being an exceptionally effective mentor and developer of leaders. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Big fan.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you again for doing this. We're looking forward to it, to hearing and learning all about you. So basically what we do when we bring people on here, it's reconnecting the family. You have a skill set in your life, man, and in the big search of things, it's for wisdom. Like, as you go through life, man, y'all have the ability, as you age is rank, and you can shorten up that wisdom into a few words and deliver it to where it's impactful and people, man, it resonates with them. And that's because life's the one thing that molded it. So,
yeah.
Well, let's hear your story. You can start from the start. Give us a whole background about you.
Sure. Well, I was born in New York State, Schenectady, New York. Took a lot of crap for that my whole career because, you know, your home, your date of birth, home of birth, Schenectady. Who the hell's heard of Schenectady? So I moved to New Jersey.
Wait. Where's that at?
Schenectady is about a half an hour south of Albany.
I've never heard of that.
Dead center, either. Yeah. Schenectady is where General Electric started. There's still a General Electric plant. And grandfather, Giuseppe Etor, came from Italy and worked at General
That's
Electric.
A great name.
That's where, yep. And so I lived there for 10 years. All I remember about it is 3 and 4 feet snowfalls. No kidding. Never had a snow day in school. Moved to New Jersey. My dad worked for the government. And you'll recognize this, Marcus. My dad was a weapons tester. And so at age 10, we moved to New Jersey so my dad could work at Picatinny Arsenal.
Oh, yeah.
And he was actually in the mid-60s, one of the testers for the M16, the early M16. So he had pictures of himself with all sorts of variants, to include an M16 variant that fired belt-fed from a backpack.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty cool.
I've always been – that's a great conversation to have with anybody from the military. It's like, man, I'm going to throw that sucker in a backpack and let it just feed over your shoulder, right?
Yeah, it didn't work.
No,
it didn't
work. Oh, no. We're still trying to get that sucker.
And skipping ahead a little bit, when I was in Beirut, my unit got the only 4 Mark 19s in existence at the time. And my dad had worked on and tested those machines.
Really?
They sent them to Beirut, and the bad guys hated them.
Yeah, hate them.
Absolutely hated them.
Yeah.
And of course, the first time I'd ever seen it was somebody using it in combat. So quite impressive.
Let me tell you something. Anyway, some of the boys get good at that thing. Like, they'll just sit there. That's what they train on. Marines are great at that. Like most every other unit in our militaries, they don't specialize in those particulars. Man, but you find somebody who gets good at that sucker, stand by. They'll rain down death on you all day.
Absolutely. And the M203 grenade launcher was new back then, 1982 timeframe. And the bad guys saw those weapons and dubbed them rocket rifles.
They just
hated it because they couldn't hear the projectile coming. So it was a great weapon. So anyway, New Jersey, stayed there until I went to high school, went to a public high school, played sports. I was a wrestler, third grade all the way through college. At high school graduation, 17 years old, I graduated on a Wednesday. Monday, I was at Paris Island. So 17 years old. So Paris Island. Tuesday, I'd wondered what the hell I'd done. You know,
right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a thing. That's an actual moment. I think we all do that. We're like, yeah. what the hell I'd done.
So I, went through boot camp, infantry, marine. Things were different back then, guys. It was post-Vietnam. Promotions were very, very fast. So I became a 19-year-old sergeant and a 20-year-old drill instructor. I was a very young drill. In fact, I was the youngest drill instructor in the Marine Corps at the time, and actually graduated my first recruit platoon when I was 20.
So you're already a Marine and training men at 20. That's...
It was a big deal, and the Marine Corps trusted me, and I tried very, very hard to live up to that trust. I went through DI school, which was a great school, best military school I'd ever gone through, professionally run, exacting, and I was one of the very, very few non-Vietnam veterans there. I mean, I was looking, guys in my squad, two Silver Stars, five Purple Hearts.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Hearts,
I didn't think about that, right? Yeah.
It was a big deal. So I was the absolute baby of the class and took no small amount of shit for it, but it was all good natured. My squad instructor, his name was Gunnery Sergeant Mata. He had broken time. He had actually been Chesty Puller's Jeep driver in Korea.
That's all you got to say about that dude. Kidding me?
And he can't be no chump
and drive them guys around.
No, this guy was awesome. So he was introducing himself to us. He got us in a little room and said, I'm Gunnery Sergeant Hector Mata. And he's talking. He goes, my first tour as a drill instructor was 1956. Well, I'm like a dumb shit. And I'm like, Gunny, that's the year I was born. And of course, everybody turns around, looks at me like, you've got to be kidding me, And he's like, yeah, thanks, Etor. I really needed that was a good start. But he was a great guy. So did 2 years on the drill field. And decided that I wanted to go to college. I was not interested in college out of high school. Wouldn't have made it. I would have been one of those one semester guys and done. But once I got in, as I'm sure you saw, Marcus, you saw the power of a degree. And I also saw another powerful example was I had great officers. I really was exposed to great officers until I went to the depot at San Diego, the recruit depot, and I still had many great ones, but I started running into some average ones and a couple below average ones as well. And it gave me incentive to say, I can do this. In fact, I'm a better officer right now than that guy, except I'm wearing stripes and I'm never going to be able to be an officer unless I go to school. So I got out with 4 years, one enlistment, went to college, phys ed major, with the sole intention, I wrestled, it was a D1 program, sole intention of getting a degree, going back in as an infantry officer. And that's what I did. So I spent 4 years of college. Back then it was a state college called East Stroudsburg State College.
Where's that at?
It's in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, north of Allentown, about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours north of Philadelphia. Pocono Mountains. It's a big honeymoon resort area. Delaware Water Gap. It was only about a half hour away from where I grew up in New Jersey, across the border. And some buddies of mine that, when I went to the Marines, they went to college to wrestle. They were just finishing up and they said, why don't you come in? So I was very fortunate. The coach, just on the recommendations of them and my high school coach, brought me in and gave me money. And so with that and the GI Bill, I was hooked up. The problem was I'd never taken the SATs and I didn't want to take the SATs. I'm not good at math at all. Writing, no problem. Math, no. And so he got me into this program, no kidding. That was the summer program. He said, if you make it through this program, we'll admit you in the fall as a regular freshman. And the program was designed for ghetto kids. They were taking kids out of the ghetto and giving them a second chance at life. And it was a real life event for me, guys. I sat there as a 22-year-old right out of the Marine Corps, like days out of the Marine Corps, and I ran into really good people, some of whom were 20 years old, couldn't read.
Oh,
wow.
High school graduates couldn't read. And I mean, the math that we were doing was probably fourth grade level, addition, subtraction, and some of them couldn't do it. And so you talk about seeing – you know, you hear about underprivileged kids and kids that are doomed by their, you know, where they were born and all that. I ran into that.
Yeah.
We probably had 100 kids in that class, and I would say less than 20 of them survived the summer.
Yeah.
And of that, probably less than 10 of them actually graduated from college. So I was not much of a student in high school, but I was good enough to, you know, to ace that course. So I got through. Again, I was a phys ed major, loved it, figured it out quickly, enjoyed college. And I realized that I was going to go back in. So I went to OCS, just regular OCS, like I'd never been in before. My junior summer, it's called the platoon leaders class, 10 weeks. And that was really good. OCS was a great course, much more physically demanding than boot camp. Much more. And amusingly, many
really?
Of the
than yeah, Marine Corps boot camp?
Oh yeah, much more. Yeah.
Because not to cut you off, sir, but people know this. If you join for the military and say I joined in the Navy, I went to Navy boot camp, you join in the Air Force, you go to Air Force boot camp, Marines go to Marine Corps boot camp, so forth and so on. If you get out and go to a different branch of service, you have to go through their boot camp. Marine Corps is the only one you don't have to do that. If you're a Marine, you can go into any service.
Yes.
You don't have to go back through their boot camps.
Yeah, I know that. You're absolutely right. So to clear up any confusion, I agree that physically, PT-wise, Marine Corps boot camp, you know, conventional boot camp, not special ops, not buds, is by and away the toughest one. The philosophy of Marine Corps boot camp, though, is you come here, we're going to get you in shape.
Yeah.
The philosophy for OCS is you come here the very best you are. We're not getting you in shape.
Sure,
we're
evaluating you got to want that right away. Right, yeah.
In fact, if you show up out of shape, they'll DQ you. You say, you're not what we're looking for. Yeah. We told you what to prepare for. So the PFT maximum in Marine Corps is 300 points. And I would say, when recruits show up, you know, a platoon average might be 210. In an officer candidate platoon, the platoon average is probably 285. And so it's much, and so they use physical training to weed you out. In fact, one of your frogman buddies who I've talked to, Mike Cirelli,
yep.
He went through Marine Corps OCS. And he said the same thing. He said it was much harder than anything I thought it was going to be, much harder than Marine Corps boot camp.
Yeah.
And so now I don't want to make it overly dramatic. It just that it
no, no,
was
no. I understand what you're saying. I hear you loud and clear. I mean, that's why I was saying that. That's a respect thing. If those are the cases, there's programs that we have in the military that, first of all, most people don't know about.
Yeah.
There's such a kick in the shorts that, if you show up there and you don't, just like you said, you don't cut it, you can't complain.
No.
There's a standard.
No.
That's the best part.
Yeah. And one amusing thing that happened at OCS was many of the drill instructors at OCS, I had been a drill instructor with at San Diego. A couple of them I had actually trained.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, came back around on you, did it?
Yeah. So, well, not really, but I got a shaved head. I'm looking like any other officer candidate. We're on like a 4 mile run through the woods and I'm running and I can see drill instructors coming. They have a different shirt on and I'm running and they're running the other way. And I realize I know both of them. I don't say a word. And they look at me like I don't
right,
believe
right.
What
that's what I was gonna ask. The blink, you know, that blink look where you're like,
yeah,
what are you?
Yeah,
how
yes.
are you?
So they stop me and they peek around my back because my name is stenciled on the back, and they're like, what in the hell are you doing here? Gonna be an officer. And they're like, why? I said, I don't think I'd make gunnery sergeant. So I figured the next best thing, if I can't make gunny, it's easier to become a lieutenant, you know? So obviously I was joking, but that was very, very interesting, you know, to go through that. So 10 weeks, made it, went back for my senior year of college, graduated, and then to Quantico, Virginia, you know, to the pipeline, went to the basic school for 6 months, very good school. And then infantry officer course for another 3, which is a great school. I mean, it really was a very, very good school. I felt fully prepared. Left there, went to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, reported into 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines, which had been the very first battalion in Beirut very peaceful at the time, and they were getting ready to go back a second time. So Beirut was the only thing that had happened for a long, long time since Vietnam. So everybody wanted to be in that battalion, and I just got lucky. You know, I got lucky. You know,
that's how it works. I mean, you can't just say that in the military all the time. If you chase it, you'll never find it. You'll always be behind it or in front of it. It's kind of like you stay.
Yes.
Kind of, and it's hard. That's the hardest thing to do, especially if you're in between, like after Nam, and it was before the storms. So I mean, the Beirut guys, and what else do we have? Panama and some other stuff. I mean, there was some of those, but that's a real thing.
Yeah,
we don't ever talk about that. That's the stuff in the military that unless you were in, you wouldn't know it.
You're exactly right. We can talk about that a little bit more when I finish the history. I think you'll probably ask a question or two. So went to Lebanon. Like I said, we took the unexpected right turn, went to Grenada. And this is, you know, pre-internet. This is 1983. And so we literally, where the hell's Grenada? You know, right. And someone found an encyclopedia in the ship's library.
Where is it?
Got no clue.
That's what I thought.
No,
go ahead.
No clue.
I was just proving your point.
About 75 miles off of the northeast coast of South America. If you look to the right, you'll see Dominican Republic, Virgin Islands, you know, some of the Caribbean islands. So it is a Caribbean island.
Yeah.
A former British colony. It's called the Spice Island. I guess the main product was nutmeg.
Yeah.
And the reason why we went there is that the Cubans, proxied by the Soviets, had gone in there, taken over the place. There was a military coup, but they had built about a 10,000-foot runway capable of landing and taking off the heaviest Soviet bombers. And Reagan said, ain't happening. You know, so he already had the crosshairs on Grenada. Then the Cubans did something very stupid. They and the bad guy militia on Grenada took two medical schools hostage.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And in those medical schools were jammed full of American students. So now we go there, and that's what it was. It was a rescue mission of the students, which specifically the Army Rangers did. And they did a great job, kick-ass job. I was up on a mountaintop watching it. Boy, it was a spectacle. And to restore democracy. So there was a military coup. The guy that was the favored guy by the Soviets on the island, Maurice Bishop, got killed by one of his buddies. So the whole place was in turmoil.
Yeah.
And it was one of the few times I think when American troops went somewhere, they really did meet us in the streets cheering us. You know, women coming out, giving us their babies to kiss. They were so happy to see us because they had been brutally oppressed by the Cubans.
Yeah.
And so I didn't run into any Cubans there. All the shooting was generally over after the first day. The Rangers and parts of the 82nd down south at the airport, you know, they get a bad rap. I don't know if you know anything about the operation, guys, but the Marine Corps came out smelling like a rose. Oh. And the Army, the larger part of the Army, they didn't do all that well. However, at the battalion level and below, they did great. And so to your point, Marcus, these guys were in some pretty stiff firefights. They had some KIAs. But if you talk to some people, they said, well, the Marines did everything. The Army didn't do shit. That's not true, and I wanted to clear that up. Right off the bat. That's really not true at all.
Yeah, that usually happens in-house, too.
Yes.
I mean, that's a beating on our chest thing. I get all that. It's when it makes it out and they try to make it, something like that. That upsets everybody.
What year was that?
83.
Yeah, it was October of 83.
Heartbreak Ridge, right? You ever seen that? Remember Heartbreak Ridge?
Yes. Yeah, that was highly inaccurate. Highly inaccurate. You know, I claim that.
I know. I just that's what made me think of it.
Yes, I claimed jokingly that they Clint Eastwood's character was somewhat patterned after me, but I think I could do more.
I liked you anyways, but the fact that you said that was great. Freaking Gunny Highway, man.
Exactly. So you'll appreciate this, Marcus. We're up in the northern part of the island. And in hindsight, there wasn't really any stiff combat there for the Marines. And I say that some guys did, but it really wasn't nothing, certainly nothing that we faced, you know, a month or so later in Lebanon. But we were in the darkness in the northern part of the island, and we got tasked to go down and rescue elements of SEAL Team 6, which was trapped in the governor's mansion. Their mission was to rescue the governor of former governor of Grenada. And so the word was, my battalion commander told me literally, he said, we're going south. There's a SEAL element in this building. They're surrounded. They got a bunch of wounded, and we're going to go get them. And without hesitation, that whole Marine unit's focus, the main effort turned from what we were doing to go down and get those guys.
That's a real thing. And there is no finer. I've had my ass saved more times by the Marine Corps than I can even talk about. The best part about this, you want to talk about bragging rights. Like SEALs, we get the cool missions. We get to hang it out there and go get into the pickles that we, most of the time, we know we can't get out of. And there's a quiet calm that comes along knowing y'all come get us. And let me tell you something. These suckers will stop eating chow and do everything in their power to get their asses down and to be the first ones to rescue. Like I said, it's a qual. It's like, man, if you got that one under your belt, it's a good one, because it doesn't happen a lot. But when it does, like I said, it's happened to me a few times. When y'all show up, it's a whole level of thank you. I mean, the next day we go back to, hey, man, you're freaking whatever.
Well, thank you for that. And I'll tell you, that's why I mentioned it. That's exactly what happened. There's no question. Americans in trouble. We moved down there. Now, once we approached, elements of our battalion approached, the bad guys left.
Yeah.
Left without firing a shot. We and the Army had knocked out a couple little BTRs and BMPs and all of that, but generally speaking, it wasn't much. And I can distinctly remember the SEALs coming down. I didn't know who the hell they were. They, of course, you know, they were dressed in different stuff and all that, beards and long hair, coming down a big mountain with a couple civilians, which happened to be the governor and his wife and all of that. And then they flew out. And I really didn't know. We really didn't know what the hell happened on the island until later, when we started reading magazines, you know, in Beirut, and there were some accounts of it, you know.
But that had been like Gothro's time frame?
Probably.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was trying to associate a time frame, and he verified what I was thinking. I was just looking at pictures from Grenada in 1983. So I've got... Yeah.
That same thing happened to us, man. We were kind of pinned down. It was ineffective at coming in at us. We were coming out of this house, actually. And we called in for an extract from it was the tanker show. The tanks showed up. I thought that was real cool. They didn't let us ride. They made us run behind it. Sorry, son. I call it the freaking Ramadi Mile, dude.
Yeah, that was
awesome. I've seen y'all break... battle lines. I mean, just blow through entire fields of operation with those suckers to get to us.
Yeah, I never appreciated tanks, and really, you know, not in a bad way. I just, you know, had no experience with them until Beirut, and to appreciate what a tank main gun round sounds like what it can do on the other end.
Right.
And we were getting bedeviled down at the airport. I was actually up in West Beirut, farther away, but my buddies at the airport were getting bedeviled with snipers. And we had a great commander. And so we started using tank main gun rounds as anti-sniper weapons.
Oh, yeah. And, that'll do it.
Suffice it to say, we rarely got another shot from the offending building. Because the offending building was never a building.
Never a building anymore.
Yeah, so it was very, very good.
As
so,
a sniper, knowing that the tank's around, that because you can drop that sucker below or above them.
Yes, interesting story. There was no armor threat there for the guys at the airport. So now we're in Lebanon, and but a lot of snipers, a lot of, you know, guys on the roof looking at Marines. They're 500 meters away, 400 meters away, 800 meters away, and they're, you know, they're having tea. They know the Marines are watching them. They're giving them the finger, all that stuff, and the binoculars, you know. And then all of a sudden, the guy would bend down, pick up a machine gun, roll out a belt, and then leave. You know, you couldn't get him. So they started watching pretty closely, and they started massing snipers, and they started whacking them hard with snipers and toe rounds.
Yeah,
you know what a toe round is. So again, and believe it or not, the bad guys actually complained to the Lebanese army who were on our side, complained that the Marines were not following the rules.
Yeah.
They
actually, isn't that great when that happens?
What's
and something that'll make you chuckle, as only bureaucracy could do, when someone in D.C., you know, Pentagon and all that, found out that our unit was using anti-tank weapons, TOWS for anti-sniper, they snarkily said, you know, those things are very, very expensive. They're $10,000 a piece, blah, blah, blah.
They hit you with the money. I hate it when they do that to y'all, and they do it a lot.
And my colonel was a very famous combat leader. His name was Ray Smith, finished up as a major general, Navy Cross recipient, couple of Silver Stars, three or four tours in Vietnam, the real deal. And his curt response to headquarters was, how much does a Marine cost? Yep. Never heard anything again.
When they do that to y'all, it aggravates me to know. Yep. I mean, first of all, to make you into a Marine is one thing. Then to hit them with that doesn't even make sense. I know y'all don't get money. Y'all don't get anything. I mean, like, they keep y'all mean for a reason. You know what I'm talking about? Like, we run into y'all and we having I'll never forget, we were like reconnaissance mission. We got there for weeks, up into a month, and they still make you have to shave and blouse. And that's routine. I understand why they do that and everything like that. But then you get to the point where, man, they just, them dogs on the chain. That's why they call y'all that, for dogs of war. And they just keep y'all mean as
Well, you know, you've seen it, Marcus. And I was just telling somebody the other night that unless you've seen it, it's hard for you to imagine the utter unbridled violence that an 18-year-old devil dog is capable of.
Hey, man. That's your story.
Caveman violence that, you know, if you've never seen it, it's even hard to imagine it. You know, it's just hard to imagine that human beings could be that focused on destroying what's ever in front of them.
I'll never forget when I saw that. I'll never forget these guys. Two of them. Fire team, we were sniper overwatch down this city. It's like apartments and everything. And I had their alley. And I stand there and watch these two jokers. I mean, building to building, up the stairwell, kicking in doors, taking gunfire, walls would blow up, and they come run out. And I watched them literally all day. And then they showed up in front of me, and it was all body armor and that helmet. You couldn't see a head in there, right? They're just kind of jacked up. They're so, you know what I'm talking about? Like these guys, I mean, 18 years old and wide eye. I mean, they didn't have the stare yet. They were still in the wide eye station. And I'm talking, I was so impressed with those two. I'll never forget them. I'll never forget them as long as I live. And watching them do that. They had the audacity to compliment me about being a frogman. Every once they found out what we were, I was like, son, I just watched you do things. And, I mean, they didn't even stop. I would have taken a break, taken a nap. I mean, it just took all day. And these suckers just kept going. I didn't get their names or anything like that. I was telling them what to do, and I didn't even compliment them. I didn't. You know, I didn't. It's just got to keep mean, right? Like, hey, great job. And they're like, oh, sweet, now I'm good. And then
you
get that.
You suck today.
And, you know, they were just happy to be there.
Yeah,
can you believe they're paying us for this?
No, I mean, it looked like that. Best thing I can think of is like when you go hunting with your lab, and that's some guy, no matter how cold it is, he's just like, what's up? You know, like that. When as soon as you say fight or war, man, they just light up like you can't believe.
Yeah, I love them. And, you know, every generation is, you know, laughed at. So when I enlisted in the Marine Corps, guys, there were still World War II vets on active duty. I mean, I had a first sergeant that was on Iwo Jima, Korean War, multiple tours in Vietnam.
How was that? How do you even work with alongside? I mean, them dudes, right?
They were awesome. Right? I can't say enough good about them. They were just awesome. You know, been there, done that. My one first sergeant had a bayonet scar on his face.
That's cool. That is awesome. That is so cool. Most guys I know beg for that scar.
It's unbelievable, you know. And so, it was unbelievable to work with those guys. So I never forgot them. And really, I spent my whole career trying to live up to the legacy of those guys, the Marines in Bellowwood in World War One. If there's one thing the Marine Corps does well, is it teaches and honors and sustains its history and traditions.
Y'all got that.
It's very, very good. So it's impossible. My kids used to see me we'd be in a Home Depot or something, and I'd see some old fat guy with a Marine Corps emblem on his forearm. He's older than dirt. And they knew. I'd reach out, like, hey, when were you in? They'd be like, oh, here we go. Half hour at least.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's just that brotherhood, you know,
and
you
they're
understand
not fat.
That.
That's like muscle that's just perpetuated. That's one thing you'll never see is an out of shape Marine in uniform. I've never seen that. That doesn't happen. And I ran across, was it 93? He was 99, the colonel that time. He was 99. One was 97. And the 88-year-old or something, he was a light colonel. They were still hazing each other. Let me tell you something. The crease in his pants was so damn sharp, you could have shaved with it. I mean, he showed up khakied out with his gold going. I was like, oh! Yeah. Hey, yeah. Marines look sharp, man. You got to give him props on the uniforms, man.
We had a friend that was a World War II Marine, R.V. Bergen, and he had a book called Island of the Damned. He was
great dude.
In the Battle of Peleliu in Palau during World War II, and we got to know him over the last several years. He died about 2 or 3 years ago.
Great man.
And we had the privilege of going to Palau, to the beaches of Peleliu, Orange Beach.
Yeah, where they went in.
Where they went in, and Marcus carried him out of the boat onto the beach.
We went out in the ocean in this flat bottom, came back in.
Yeah.
I remember walking over the beach with him. I was frog manned out too. I was like, whoa, what's up? I was like, well, did you start killing right here? I was like, was he behind this tree? And he goes, no, we came in, it was scorched earth.
Yeah.
He's like, we had gone in. And then he was pointing out, he's like, there's the bluffs over here and there was an inlet. And he's like, 250 Marines went in over there. None made it out. Aww. He's like, 250 went over here. I think 5 made it out. He goes, we came in here. He's like, I woke up one night and he had this old redneck, or he might have been a corn fed country boy.
He's from Dallas.
Sleeping in this hole. He's like, he woke up. The dude was choking him, trying to kill him. He's like, he picked him up over his head and freaking. And I'm just sitting there looking at this dude going, my God, man, you know.
Well, and when we saw it, the island was beautiful. Just lush jungle. Yes. Beautiful.
Yeah. Frozen in time.
Yeah, in that there's still the anti-aircraft guns, like, sitting there. You can go. Yeah. It's like going to an outdoor museum.
Swords leaning against a tree. Yeah. AKs laying on the ground. Like, you're driving down the road, and the driver would pull over. He's like, check this out. And we go over this hill, and there'd be an anti-tank cannon buried in the – it's still in the pillbox. Just rusted up, just sitting there. It's like when they called the war, it stopped right there.
If you ever want to see real time, like an actual museum without all the fluff crap that's at a museum, like real frozen in time, go to the island of Peleliu in the islands of Palau.
And it's just beautiful too.
It is so beautiful.
It's awesome.
It's actually pretty cheap to get there because nobody goes.
Yeah.
And it's really far. It took us like 24 hours to get there. But
that's damn far.
It was really, really far. But it was the neatest experience that I think we've ever shared with. I mean,
because the history's still there.
The history
and the Marines,
was
I mean,
just
having
amazing.
Him there, it's like, y'all been all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
The cool part about Marines, there's not very many of y'all, but y'all keep track of that.
Well, I know the history of the battle well. And to your early remark, Marcus, about, you know, little hidden battles, Peleliu, of guys that were in all or most of them, Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal, I mean, this is a tall statement. They all said there was nothing like Peleliu.
Yep.
Nothing.
Think about that.
Like Peleliu.
That scares the hell out of me, man. You know, like a fight like that, we like really killing. That's some crazy stuff, man.
It just wasn't covered all that much with press. So you had Marines in the Pacific even that never really understood how savage that battle was. That's where Lee Marvin got shot in the ass, Peleliu.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he got wounded.
Yeah. That's it's really crazy. And it was the largest loss of life of Marines in history was in the Battle of Peleliu. And they thought it was supposed to be, they thought that, what was it, Admiral Nimitz or something, thought that they were going to overtake the whole island in like, they estimated like 7 days to completely take it over. And it ended up taking like 4 or 5, maybe 6 months, something like that. Yeah. They ended up winning in the end, but it took a lot longer and cost hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of lives. I don't remember exactly, yeah. But it was crazy.
Regarding Marine Bergen, I never knew him. I know who he is. Mm-hmm. I am actually in the process of writing a book on combat and combat leadership. And I'm quoting him several times in that book. He's got some YouTube videos.
He'd love that.
He's looking down on you, and he loves it.
Yeah. He's a Marine. I mean, straight up, still mowed his yard and pressed and cagged. That's awesome.
He still wore his Marine belt buckle at 95, 96 years old every single day.
He had a picture of them, the guys that were left on Palau.
Yeah.
They were on a beach, standing up against the woods with their. They had clothes left, right? So what was ever left of it? And how skinny they were, pure muscle. Like when you see when them guys, those war fighters that come back, you know, they just look like
gone.
Yeah, man, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see, where did I leave? We're still in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And I on the way to Lebanon, I was told that I was an older second lieutenant, obviously, with my enlisted time. So I was told that myself and my platoon sergeant named Staff Sergeant Mike Marshall, great guy, evidently we were considered by the battalion commander to be the strongest lieutenant staff sergeant team in the battalion. That's flattering. So we got tasked with taking.
You say, you're two squared away. That means something too, right?
Well, I mean, I'm flattered, but, you know, I like to say he carried most of that weight. He was great, great guy. Just recently passed away, unfortunately, but he was certainly my right hand man. And, you know, I like to say one of the best subordinates I ever worked for. You know, he kept me out of trouble completely. And all I had to do was just say something or give a look. And I got it, sir. So we got it, you know, and he was one of those staff NCOs. So we took 104 Marines up to West Beirut to an area that was being used as the temporary U.S. embassy. And it included the British embassy because the U.S. embassy had been truck bombed the previous April of 84. The U.S. embassy got destroyed by a van packed with explosives. 60 some people got killed. So I was set up there with the Marines at that time. I didn't realize at the time, but I soon found out that I actually had more Marines as a second lieutenant 5 miles away from everybody else than my company commander had, back at the airport. So I started busting his ass. We were the same age. He was a great guy, and saying, sir, you need to send that company guy down up to me because this is really Fox company, you know, not what you got left down at the airport.
Yeah.
So I don't think you want to hear what he said to me, but it wasn't polite. So we
have a great way of articulating that.
Yeah. So I stayed up there with my Marines, and we stayed there for about 4.5 months. And this is a really good story at the risk of sounding self-aggrandizing. I'm saying this as a lesson to current leaders. So Reagan pulls all the Marines offshore and says, come back on the ships. With the exception of me and my group in West Beirut. So now you've got everybody's on the ship and you have a second lieutenant with 104 Marines left ashore. And it's nasty. I mean, stuff's going on. When the Pentagon found out that a second lieutenant was ashore, intense pressure rolled down through the chain of command. Like, look, I'm sure he's a good lieutenant, but I mean, this is a field grade officer. You gotta do that. And my battalion commander and the MU commander had been in Vietnam together. And they basically said, they literally said, look, don't know if you know this, but him and his staff sergeant and those Marines been up there alone for 3 months already. And they've handled everything. This guy's got it. And they resisted that pressure and allowed me to stay. I never knew that until about 5 or 6 years after we got back, that they had gone to bat to me and for me and fight. So the moral of the story is, I like to think I was up to the task. I had a strong staff NCO, and that my colonel and the brigadier general saw no need to put a major or a lieutenant colonel in. Nothing had changed except the Marines were now on the ships, and they said, we trusted him. He's got it. He's keeping it. And they let me stay for another month and three quarters up there, you know, by myself with my staff sergeant and all these Marines. And we got replaced one for one by the follow-on.
Oh, yeah. Ripped y'all out.
Wow.
So it's all about trust.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about trust. And you know, I'm sure you guys have seen this. In peacetime, everybody needs an officer involved, a chief petty officer, a gunny involved.
Yeah. Yeah,
as soon as combat starts, okay, Corporal, take this patrol out.
Right,
Lance Corporal, you got it.
Oh, yeah.
And so, as you know, the time to start that is not in combat. It's in peacetime and whatever. Trust it.
I don't know why we do it that way. It's a repetitive, I guess, for something to do, right? I mean, I guess I wasn't in long, and I got stuck in the... My positional authority is center of the hourglass. Like, I can deal with the officers all the way up to the stars and then all the way down to the lowest guy. I love it.
Yeah.
I never wanted to leave it.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of practice, but there's so many gifts holding that rank, and I know exactly what you're talking about. It's true. We got to go on the Truman the other day, and you know, the average age of people who run that aircraft carrier around 19 to 22, right?
Yeah.
Which is
so bizarre.
If you knew that's just a floating city that's run by, I mean, the 17-year-old that has the wheel of that sucker.
Yeah.
Like, literally has the wheel.
I know. I was like, who has this job to actually drive the ship? And they're like, oh, this kid over here that was younger than our son. No, I was like, what?
Who I wouldn't even let my drive my tractor. You know what I'm talking about? An aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sucker doesn't turn around on a dime.
Sometimes you a turn.
And I mean, that's the coolest part about the military. It's just like the moms and dad, the old men in there are 40 and 50s, which they're still having a great time.
Yeah.
And the discipline and respect that rolls down to the younger ones in there, the responsibilities that you can't see that when you're in. I didn't know that. It's almost like going through all those lessons over and over again. You learn something and you can't really appreciate it till you well past it.
Yeah,
well
exactly.
Past it.
Well, we left Beirut. I came back and then, you know, regular peacetime infantry stuff. Went back, went to Paris Island as an officer. And then when it was time to go back to the fleet, I went to the 8th Marines again, this time with 1-8. The unit had been hit in the
in Beirut. How was that linking up with those guys?
Well, they were all gone mostly, except some of the older guys had left and come back.
Yeah.
I made sure that, you know, we all made sure that the history wasn't lost. And I was very touched. One of my TBS and IOC classmates got killed by a mortar round, landed right between him and his staff sergeant in August of 83. His name was George Losey. Great guy. And everybody loved this guy. Great guy. So I went to his funeral, was actually one of his pallbearers in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I'm going to Beirut now in a month or two. And so I remember George, obviously. Every time I stop at the Beirut Memorial in Jacksonville, North Carolina, I touch his name on the wall. Well, I go, and you know how you have these hails and farewells, you know, when someone joins the unit, they introduce the new guys and the old guys are leaving and they give them plaques. Well, as part of the farewell, one of the lieutenants says, I've had a great time here and it's now my job to pass on Lieutenant Losey's field jacket to another deserving lieutenant. And I realized that they had gotten George's field jacket when he got killed, preserved it, and were passing it from one lieutenant to the other in perpetuity.
Oh, wow.
To not forget it. And wow. I was...
That's awesome.
I was speechless.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I was the only one in the room that knew George Losey.
Oh, yeah.
And it was quite touching. I mean, there was blood on his field jacket and all of that, you know. And so I stood up, and no one knew me at the time in the unit. I stood up and gave a little talk about, hey, I'm so touched for this. I know him and all that. So it's one of those priceless things that happen, unscripted happen, and they still have the field jacket.
Oh, I
bet. In fact, they've made a case for it now, a glass case, presentation case, and they still honor it. It's still in the headquarters building of 1st Battalion, 8th Marines.
That's cool. That's another cool thing y'all do.
Yeah,
absolutely. That passed down, and it has nothing to do with. I mean, the artifact itself is one thing, but I mean, just what goes into carrying that sucker. yeah. history behind
absolutely
it.
Absolutely right.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely right. And so I was part of the battalion 1-8. We got activated for Desert Storm. So we went over to Desert Storm. I was the commanding officer of a weapons company. So I had all of the gun vehicles, the mortars. I was, you know, the guy that would coordinate the fire support plan. So it was a great, time to be a weapons company commander, because we actually did call airstrikes, artillery, mortars, and all of that. And we were on, you know, generally speaking, Desert Storm is known for, you know, we just collapsed the Iraqis quickly and they surrendered. Again, just, I guess, luck or maybe not how you look at it. I was in the battalion that was the right flank, the boundary of the 2nd Marine Division. And there was a hardball road running from south to north. And that was the boundary between us and 1st Marine Division. So what happened was 1st Marine Division was pushing up. The Iraqis were running away and they didn't know we were there waiting for them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I actually had a couple of tote gunners that whacked so many tanks one morning. They both got, they each got a Silver Star, and there were only 4 Silver Stars in the division that were awarded. I wrote them both as Bronze Stars. I knew they were solid. The division commander that approved them was a very experienced guy, Vietnam guy. And it came back that he thought that they justified. So they did interviews and all that, solid Silver Stars. So they got, you know, PFC and a Lance Corporal.
Sure.
The citations.
Well, yeah, I've heard of that going down too. When it gets upgraded, when it gets pushed up, and because of the age, like if they're a certain age, acting like holding the weight of somebody who's been around a long time. I didn't know that. There's actually a lot that goes into it. Like, and if you get somebody with some, like a real young kid, I mean, it just does, like steps up.
Like Dakota. Yep.
Something like that. That's how that
happened. Exactly.
Yeah, like
I had a Lance Corporal. It's funny, in Beirut, it's not funny, but this kid was sent to me from another unit, and he was kind of considered a bit of a turd. He had some difficulties, home life difficulties with his parents and all that, and so he was late coming back off leave, so he was UA.
Yeah.
And some of his immediate leadership kind of gave up on him. So when it found out that I needed reinforcement, they sent him up. He became my driver. Well, there was an ambush of helicopters coming in, and a Marine got hit. And this kid ran out under fire, bullets flying all around him, dragged him. So he's talking to me. He's dragged him about 50 yards behind a concrete embankment, is talking to me, telling me, you know, Corporal Gargano is hit. Don't know how bad it is, but he's bleeding a lot. We need a medevac, but to your point, don't bring the bird in here because we're under fire. Bring it into an alternate LZ. I'm looking at my radio like running the show, you know.
And, who is this?
We did exactly that.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a couple of senior Marines in the LZ with them that had come up. They were not mine. They were maintenance Marines. I don't want to dog them and identify them, but they were senior Marines, and they went to ground and stayed there. And Lance Corporal Gorham ran the show and got them all back. Unfortunately, the Marine was dead. And so I had to identify his body. And to show you how it's micromanagement that you've seen, Marcus, is, you know, I report to the airport, look, he's ambush going on and all that. And they're actually being really good to me. You know, they know, you know, we're under fire and all of that. And we got micromanaged all the way from DC. And it was like, they called me and said, our battalion S3 was a good man, a major. And he said, Mike, on the radio, he goes, I hate to tell you this, he said, but they want to know exactly where he got hit. So you have to like kind of undress him and look.
Yep.
So I went in the back of a vehicle and opened him up, rolled him over, and I could hear blood sloshing in him because he got hit right in the armpit.
Oh, yeah.
Like a 7.62 round. Yeah,
filled him up.
And so, you know, that was just an aside. So I was pissed that we got micromanaged like that, but we sent it up. Where I'm going with this is I wrote Gorham for a Bronze Star with V. His company commander down at the airport agreed. The battalion commander agreed. The MU commander agreed. Gets to DC. There's some shit going on, you know?
Yeah.
And someone at DC actually said they were probably going to downgrade it. And it was just because they hadn't done awards yet since Vietnam. And to be honest with you, Marcus, I think there was envy involved.
Sure.
And a staff officer actually told me, well, you know, a Navy comm with a V for a Lance Corporal is still pretty good. And, you know, I was a bit of a surly guy, a surly first lieutenant. And I'm like, hey, sir, we give Lance Corporals medals of honor.
Yeah.
And everyone in the chain says Bronze Star and V. Who are you or anybody else that doesn't even know what happened? Who are you guys just to arbitrarily change it? And so my battalion commander, again, who was highly respected, he got mobilized.
Sure.
And twice it to say.
As they do. Yeah, right.
About a year after we submitted it, Gorham received a Bronze Star with V.
Oh, that's awesome.
Great kid.
That's awesome.
Truly deserved. Everybody that was there that day, I was taking statements and all of that. Everybody that was there that day clearly said he was the commissioned officer that day at that moment. The show.
St. Pat, he died on Red Wing, but the first time he ever called in on a comp, we had an engagement going on, and he was so calm on the radio that they weren't going to send anybody. The only reason they came is because they heard it going on. He's like, yeah, we got this. He was a California kid.
surfer
kid, dude. And I mean, he was just laying it on there. I mean, you couldn't train that out of him, right? It's like that accent that goes perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect military bearing, had all the verbiage and everything. He's like, check. Yeah, we are. So that exists. People take that out of the equation when we're in that stuff. But man, you need to put the personalities in there because that makes that hilarious, right? Yeah. And there are guys with such great personalities. When the shit hits the fan, it comes out. And I'm talking about. And see, I think it's the only way we get through all that is you got to have them dudes there. Otherwise, I don't know.
Well, I think what you're alluding to is the fact that, you know, I'm sure the frogmen are the same as Marines, incessant shit talkers to each other.
100%.
Including during firefights.
In the moment. In the moment.
Including making fun of each other, taunting each other.
In the freaking moment.
Marcus
that is a real
makes
thing.
Fun of his best friends. And sometimes I'm like, babe, that was kind of rude. You should probably apologize. And he's like, that was hilarious.
That was my best line ever. What are you talking about?
That was
apologize.
So funny. And I'm like, I think that was rude. You might have hurt his feelings. He's like, no, I am not apologizing.
I mean, in the moment, those things. And a movie quote or a line or somebody will say something to you, you're like, that has to happen, I think, right? That's just how you know you're going to make it through that. When them suckers start flying
out. He tried telling me one time to land my plane when I was, giving him a long explanation of something. And I was like, what the fuck did you just say to me?
I never lived that one down, man.
Do not tell me to land my plane. And I think you said woman. Land your plane, woman. I'm like, what?
You're like, no, not that part.
You're not going to talk to me like that.
That probably happened, but I'm going to say that sounds made up.
You definitely could.
Let's get back to what Mike was saying. Go ahead.
Well, after the Gulf War, I came back went to the basic school at Quantico as an instructor. I wanted to go. I had a feeling that I was going to retire soon, you know, at my enlisted time. And I wanted to go back and give back to the lieutenants. And I did that. I stayed there for 3 years and I just loved it. Loved being surrounded by the young guys. Just loved it. Had a great time. They sent me to command. I made major. They sent me to command and staff college. And it was there that I suddenly realized I want to try something else. You know, I mean, I didn't know 9/11 was coming or I would have never left. Of course, I might not be alive today, but I, you know, it was nothing going on. Didn't predict anything was happening. And I realized that I was more excited. You know, I had a good career. I answered all the questions about myself that I wanted to answer. And, you know, I was going to be a lieutenant colonel and probably a colonel. I was going to get all those good jobs, but I was more excited about proving that I was an equally good leader in the business world as I was in the Marine Corps. So I realized, Mike, if the thought of being an infantry battalion commander excites you less than going out and trying your hand in business, you need to go out and try your hand in business. All right. You know? And so that's what I did. I was hired by a company. Well, my first job, you'll recognize this, Marcus. My first job was I was one of the very first guys hired by Trigicon.
Oh, yeah.
And so my job was to take.
Oh, so you just kind of step over and yeah, that makes sense. A lot of guys do that. Yep.
Yes. My last job in the Marine Corps, I had very, very good clearances. I was in a liaison role with some of the, what we called back then, the tier one forces.
Yes, sir.
And some of the government agencies. And so I was one of the guys that would link up with those fellas and then bring them to various Marine exercises and introduce them to guys that were read in and say, hey, if you're ever somewhere and you get real time info that the LZ that you plan on using, you can't use it, but you need to go there, these are the guys that you're going to be talking to. So that's, you know, I'm dancing around a subject, but because of that, I met really good people and really good clearances. So when I worked for Trigicon, the Trigicon reflex site that you know about and used, I had the prototypes in my hands and I brought them to Damneck and to Fort Bragg to guys I knew and said, would you shoot these? They're like, yeah, come right back in 2 weeks.
All right.
Went back to 2 weeks and basically they said, shot 10,000 rounds through it. Love it. Can you make a green, yellow, and red reticle? And can you make a cross, a pyramid, and a circle? And I'm like, sure, we can do that. So, you know, feedback from those kind of shooters is priceless.
Yep.
Loved it. Pre-9/11, I was dragging an AR-15 in a case through the airport and all that, you know.
That's carry-on.
Yeah, no carry-on. I had to check it, but, you know.
It's bulky, but it's a carry-on.
Yeah, exactly. But I, about 10 months into that, I got contacted by a buddy, Marine buddy, whose sister was married to this CEO of a company named K-Force, which was a IT and finance and accounting staffing company, headhunters. They found jobs for people, the finance guys, accountants, and then tech guys, tech people, bona fide techies. And the guy loved Marines and hired me specifically to start a leadership development program, specifically to hire junior Marine officers that were getting out and to train people on the inside. And I did that. We did it well. And then the dot-com crash hit. The company almost went out of business. That was the bad news. The good news is there was a lot of opportunity for me. People were leaving, quitting, getting fired, whatever. And they just started throwing more responsibility. So about 4 years into it, I started there in 99, March of 99. About 4 years later, I was a C-level officer in charge of most of the back office, the non-sales functions for a $1 billion company. No expertise in any of it. When I left the Marine Corps in 98, I wasn't really sure how to save a file. And forwarding an attachment
right
completely blew this grunt's mind. You know, I had to get a young guy to help me all the time. And then 2 years later, I was in charge of a $45 million budgeted IT department. And so the good story of this is I was new to business, didn't know what a publicly traded company was. But I realized pretty quickly that I was not new to leadership and organizational skills, like, you know, so many veterans have come out here and done. And I stayed there 15 years. Can't say enough good about the people I worked with. They gave me chances, a frightening amount of authority and all of that.
Right.
After 15 years, I retired from that company, thought I was done. I'd done well financially, thought I was done, just going to play, you know, learn how to play golf, PT or whatever. And during that first year, I was pretty tired. During that first year, guys, I probably had lunch or coffee with 30 people. And they were asking me business advice, leadership advice. Look, I got this situation going on. What would you do? And I realized I was coaching and mentoring, which I still love to do.
Right.
Didn't want to be anywhere at 8 o'clock in the morning anymore.
Yeah.
But I wanted. And so I opened up my executive coaching practice and love it. So I teach and coach senior executives in the art and science of leadership. And here's a guy that thought he was done, never going to work again. I will do this as long as I breathe. I just love leadership, teaching, and helping, you know, people develop as leaders. Just love it.
Well, I mean, if that's the best part about making the rank, when you get to that age and to that experience, because the coaching and teaches, it teaches yourself. I mean, it gives back. Every time somebody new walks in there, they're going to drop something on you that you can pick up and somehow articulate it back in. And it's almost as if, you know, when we first come in, we don't know anything, and then we have to go through the warrior, the gardener, the all that, up into the point to when it's time for you to start passing that back down. And it's so sharp by then that it's the wisdom, right, and the understanding and the knowledge. Yeah. And you're right. It's an energy that goes with that. Now, they were talking about 8 a.m. I was like, what are you talking about? I ain't doing nothing at 8 a.m. anymore. I don't want to jog for PTE. But I'll damn sure coach somebody.
Yeah. No, I love it. You're exactly right. So I'm 65 years old, have just unlimited energy, and I get excited about this stuff. I start spitting at the screen. I just love it. And I, you know, my body's pretty broken from PT and jumping and stuff. But leadership-wise, there's two things I say. I'm at the height of my game leadership-wise. And then when you turn that coin over, guys, at 65, with over 45 years leading, teaching leadership, learning about leadership, I still learn something about every week. I'm like, how in the hell have I gone this long and never heard that? Yeah. Never heard that lesson or technique. So
can
I realize the journey's never going to be over. Never going to be over.
That's in life wonderful. She's wonderful, right? There's always something for us to teach us as long as we want to learn it.
Absolutely.
At a certain point, yeah, in the beginning, I mean, like you're born into the treasure chest, but you have to leave to find the keys. And the further you travel, the more keys you get. And then when you come back, what happens is that they start coming to you. Like they'll just bring all their treasures to you, and you give them that life lesson. It opens them up, and then they release that treasure. I mean, yeah, that's I've never heard it said like that.
You're
but
exactly
that's,
right. So in the military, we're big on mission statements. So if you go to my website, there's a My Purpose page, and my purpose, I'm going to condense it. My purpose is to teach and coach and help leaders develop while I'm alive and after I'm gone.
Well,
to do it after I'm gone, that means I have to write. And so I sent you guys some books that I've written, and I am vain enough to think that 25, 50, 80 years from now, if somebody picks my book up, the Iwo Jima lessons that I learned, the Grenada lessons, the business lessons that I've learned and spun my own way, just might help out my great, great grandson or daughter who'd never met me. And they'll look at it and say, you know, on this one, old Pops was wrong. On this one, though, he's dead on and it's still applicable, you know. So that's my mission in life, is to help leaders, help develop world-class leaders while I'm here and long after I'm gone.
That's awesome.
Yeah, almost like you're writing it to yourself five generations down.
That's exactly right. I mean, I write that in the books. You know, I write to my that, you know, this book is for my great great grandchildren who, you know, are probably 80 years out. You know,
right.
They're not there yet. You know?
How about somebody said that to me the other day? Like, hey, man, you ever pray for your kid's wife or husband?
I do.
And then do you, like, when you write stuff, do you write stuff for not only like the self help book for them raising their kids kind of deal? And
yes. Well, one of the books I wrote, the big book I sent you, is Trust-Based Leadership. That's 574 pages.
I saw it when I walked into the desk. Don't worry, I'm cracking in.
Well, you know, if you don't want to read it, you can use it as a sappy plate, you know, because it's a big, thick, heavy book, you know. That's my textbook for my coaching and teaching. If you crack that open, just look at the table of contents, you're going to recognize it all.
Roger that.
I wrote another one called Ancient Wisdom. And I've been a big fan of the Stoics for years.
Yes, sir.
And that is a collection of 100 ancient quotes, Socrates, Aristotle, people like
that. Would love that.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Marcus loves that.
And then for what it's worth, this is what Mike Etor thinks about it. And I wrote that specifically for my descendants and others, so they could see at age 65, what did the old boy think? What was in his mind?
Yeah, right.
And time will tell whether I was mostly right, somewhat wrong, or completely full of shit.
You put in the resume ahead of it. Like a lot of those self-help books just have what they write down the quote.
Right.
But if you don't understand why that quote was written or by whom or right. what life molded that person to say that, yeah. then you can't really, I mean, yeah, you can apply it, but it's also good to look back on like, okay, why is he saying it this way? Because yeah. he went down this tunnel or this rabbit hole in life. And yes. Man, yeah, I love those. And the fact that they're around for thousands of years, like if there's yes. one of those things that's just been around for a while, man, you need to, that's one you need to focus on.
Well, you're exactly right. If you look at any ancient quotes, the philosophers, the Stoics, the Romans, the Greeks, these guys had it figured out 2,500 years ago.
Short, sweet, to the point. That's why they say Stoic, right? They say a few words.
Yes. They had human nature figured out thousands of years ago. Now, technology's changed, civilization's sure. changed, but human nature hasn't changed and will not change at right. all.
Yeah, so do you have kids, grandkids?
I do. I have 4 children. And I have 2 grandchildren, a 10-year-old boy and an 8-year-old daughter, granddaughter.
Congratulations.
And yeah, and so they've got copies of the books. And and I told them, you know, this is for your children and grandchildren. They, you know, they just looked at me like, what? Has he been drinking? You know, what right. the hell's going on? Right.
You know? Oh, I love to think, like, I always tell Marcus, like, I can't wait until we're grandparents. I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, that's the pass down, right? Because you don't really get along with your father. It even says that in a good book. You ain't supposed to really get along with that dude, right? You love your mother and the love by your mom. Your grandfather, yeah. you love that guy.
Yeah.
Your great-grandfather, you're probably a lot like him, and you're probably exactly like your great-grandfather, right?
That's that you're exactly right. I've got 2 sons, you know what I mean? I remember telling my youngest one, who was... Mike the second, he was kind of a thickhead, exactly like me as a kid. And I said, Mike, let me tell you something. I said,
hey, Mike.
just because it comes out of my mouth doesn't automatically mean it's bullshit. I
said, well, I'm having to deal with that now.
At least give me like a 30% truth factor that it's not all bullshit. Some of it's right. And I said, I guarantee you, as you get older, you're going to find yourself becoming me at some point.
Oh, sure. Know? Sure, sure. I even look at my son now. I'm like, hey, that was a good one, right? Was it good? And then sometimes I'm like, yeah, that was a pretty good one, right? You know, and then some of them, the irony is the fact that his friends, what they respect me for and what they look to me for are the same things that my son doesn't like about, like discipline, uh-huh. Study, clean your room, do all that stuff like that.
Oh my gosh. Sometimes the kids will be like, what's dad talking about?
Oh, they look at me like I'm the stupidest.
Well, I tell parents and I tell my kids, you know, there's a time when you can be mommy and daddy, and then there's those very important times when you have to be mother and father.
Oh yeah.
And boy, you can't substitute one for the other, mm-hmm. or you're going to screw the kid up. Yep. When you're a grandfather, you get to be granddaddy.
Yeah, anything,
the whole
right?
time,
that's the cool part. I've always heard that. Yeah, I'm dealing with that, and so I stay on the father's side. There's no dad in me, man.
I'm
talking about my boys, not my daughter.
Yeah, he does have a little bit in him. He's got a little bit of daddy in him.
A little weakness in there,
in somewhere.
I was blessed to know very well I still have all 4 of my grandparents. I had my great grandparents and my great greats when I was little.
Wow.
So, they live forever.
Yeah.
This family over here lives forever.
Yeah. They were all over 100 when they died. And so.
Wow.
Yeah, and sharp. I mean, sharp as a tack. Can't even.
Yeah. I was 10 when both my great great grandmas died. And I clearly remember them. I remember stories they told me. And it's funny because I'm just like my great great grandmas. Like, I have the same hobbies.
Yeah, that's
I'm
the best
clearly era. Like a 100-year-old person because I have the same hobbies as my great-great-grandmas did when they were near death. But I love remembering the stories that they would tell me, and I wish they would have written it down so I could pass it on. But I tell the oral history that they told me. I remember when they told me about the first time they ever saw electricity in a building. And it wasn't their home. They didn't have it in their home for a really long time. But when they first saw it and when they first saw a car, and I was just so fascinated with those stories. I mean, even my grandparents didn't have indoor plumbing. They lived out in the middle of nowhere, Louisiana, until the 50s.
Yeah, it's almost like we're a different species.
Yeah.
Because we're the hybrid stuck in the COVID babies especially. But the millennials that are born into tech... I mean, we're different classes of people.
Yeah.
Like, we're just,
there's no doubt. And relative to, you know, knowing your grandparents and great grandparents, I didn't know any of my grandfathers. They both died when my mom was pregnant for me. Both grandmothers, one spoke no English, the other one spoke halting English, and I wasn't really, we were lived far away from them. So where I'm going with this is I have nothing from my grandparents. I don't know why they all came from Italy. You know, were they running from something or running towards, I don't know.
Right, right, right.
I never had a political discussion with my dad. My dad was a man, a good guy, a man of few words, but we never just had those deep conversations. And so I've got nothing to pass on to my children. And I determined that that's not going to happen with me.
That's great.
For better or worse, people are going to know what Mike Etor thought 50 years from now, you know?
I love it.
That's how it starts.
Yeah.
When we got married and have the kids on the ground, I got an old book from a courthouse and I write down when people visit, I'm like, hey, write some wisdom down for my kids. Mm-hmm. I just keep it at the front door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I started Christmas tradition. I got dork out over the holidays. And sometimes I'll be like, hey, how did this start? Like, it's been in our family since God put us down here, thousands of years. And I'm the one that started it. You know what I mean? Yeah. But like, hopefully some of them will stick. Like, yeah. Some of them will stick. And that's how you remember that. And that's it's like the funny part. It's like something that you enjoyed and you started, and that's the pass down. Because you'll see it again. I mean.
Well, that's why you love my grandparents so much, because we have so much tradition. And
I love it. You know, I'm always fascinated. I study the old, what they call the robber barons, Carnegie and Ford and all of those guys. Amazingly smart guys. Got Elon Musk of their days.
Right.
And they all got fantastically rich. And then at some point, they began competing about how much money they could give away.
Right, right. Isn't that great?
And to goad them into it, Andrew Carnegie, who one time had more money than the U.S. government and actually loaned the government, I don't know, a big money, maybe $100 million to make payroll. He actually said one time, to spur the other guys on, he said, a man who dies rich dies disgraced.
Yeah.
Dang.
And so he built libraries. And I read that and I'm like, you know, I'm never going to have Andrew Carnegie money, but I got a laptop and a thumb drive. And when they finally plant me, if I can hold off for a few years, everything that's up here is going to be out.
Yeah.
I'm not bringing anything out with me that isn't replicated in, you know, writing or electronic format and all of that. So I like that. I think it's noble. And everything I do, you know, my Facebook, I write on my Facebook. I got a lot of friends, but I'm very conscious that I'm writing something that someone's going to read 80 years from now that's somehow connected with me.
Yeah. I got a competition with some of my buddies who can be the best man on the planet before we die. Yeah. I'm like, I'll do you in goodness. You want to go? Let's go. Hey, I mean, it's funny. Because the first part of our lives, we were taught to hurt, kill, maim. You know, we're real good at that.
Yeah.
Not only that, we can get our buddies together and take an entire country down with a handful of us.
No doubt.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That's terrifying. Everyone who loves, I mean, I think about that now at this age. And we've gotten to the point where, like, Nicholas and all of them back in the day, they didn't have the tech. Like, they would have to spend all that money to get, like, reach into that phone and get the advertising or talk to that person. That is a wonderful thing about that phone. Is like, you can actually reach over and learn something on the other side of a planet when you want to.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
I love it. I try to learn something every day. And if I'm sitting there around 9:30, I'm like, you know, I don't know if I learned anything. I'll go on YouTube and, like, you know, I'm not really sure how a jet engine works. I'll just put up a video. And
everything's
so
on there.
Yeah.
I'm actually pissed that YouTube and that wasn't invented when I was a kid, because I'd have been on it learning all sorts of stuff.
Are you kidding me?
You know?
It'd been a completely different life. That's a game changer right there, man.
Like, absolutely.
You know, I mean, what... Game changer.
Yeah.
When you can pull something up there and be a mechanic, it's all the guys like us. I like to see it and someone telling me and then watching them do it to where you can. That's a beautiful way to teach.
Yes.
100% agree with that, man.
Thank you for sharing your story. You're so fascinating. I love hearing it.
It's my privilege. Thank you. Like I said, I'm a big fan of you and your family and Marcus and Morgan's service. So when when Dave Sears told me, hey, look, I put in a good word for you. I hope it's going to stick. I was like, oh, man, I hope so. You know? So,
oh, yeah, it did, bro. Man, I tell you, it's been a joy to have you on. I love it when you can tell that you're a leader because you can keep – wait. I didn't even realize how far we've gone. A long time, man. I mean, the conversations have just been
on point. Well, thank you. How can we help promote you? How can people find you on social media? Give us –
Thank you. I'm all over on social media. So Mike Etore, E-T-T-O-R-E. My website is fidelisleadership.com, like Semper Fidelis, F-I-D-E-L-I-S, fidelisleadership.com. You can just Google my name, Mike Etore Leadership, and all the books I've written will show up on, you know, Barnes & Nobles and Amazon and all of that. So my contact info is out. I love leadership. If anybody's interested, give me a shout. And I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to talk to you. It's been a pleasure meeting you.
Yes, awesome. Sir.
Thank you. It was great meeting you, too.